Lime Street at 2, written by Helen Forrester and read by Leanne Rose Bunce.
Chapter 1. The huge clock still hangs in Lime Street Station, Liverpool, and marks a convenient spot for travellers to be met. During World War II, almost every girl in Liverpool must have written to a serviceman coming home on leave, "I'll meet you under the clock at Lime Street." There were always women there, dressed in their shabby best, hair long, curled and glossy, pacing nervously under that indifferent timepiece. Every time a train chugged in, they would glance anxiously at the ticket collector's wickets, while round them swirled other civilians and hordes of men and women in uniform, khaki, navy blue or Air Force blue, staggering under enormous packs and kit bags. Some men wore foreign uniforms, with shoulder flashes of refugee armies, navies and air forces. No matter who they were, they all shared the same expression of deep fatigue. This huge vortex of uprooted humanity was supervised by stolid-looking military police standing like rocks against a tide. Some of them were American snowdrops, so nicknamed because of their white helmets. Occasionally, a single English civilian policeman stood out amongst all the other uniforms, a reminder of peacetime and sanity, when a quiet, "Now move along there, please," was enough to reduce a pushing crowd to order. The station may be rebuilt, the generations pass, but the ghosts are still there. Ghosts of lovers, husbands, sons, withered like flowers on distant battlefields long forgotten, and of mothers, wives and sweethearts long since dead. Amongst those kindly shades stands Harry O'Dwyer, the fiancé of my youth, a ship's engineer, lost at sea in 1940. I do not know how I got through that dreadful summer of 1940, after the news of Harry's death, or the long, hopeless year of 1941. It was a period when the merchant navy was decimated by German submarines and aircraft. Once a man was at sea, there was not a moment when he was not in acute danger. Over the bar in Liverpool Bay, the U-boats waited, like cats at a mouse hole, for the slow, ill-defended freighters entering and leaving the ports of Liverpool and Birkenhead. If they survived the submarines, they could strike acoustic mines, magnetic mines, and other menaces plopping about in the heavy waters. Even snugly moored in dock, ships were often the target in air raids, and the homes of their crews, packed in dockside areas, were frequently destroyed. I live within a mile of the South Docks with my father and mother, four brothers and two sisters. I was the eldest child. We were a most unhappy family, our lives fraught with the bitter quarrels of our parents and our considerable penury. When I was a child, we had lived in comfortable circumstances, but in 1930, my father had gone bankrupt as a result of the Depression. In an effort to find employment, father had brought us to Liverpool, his birthplace. Like most of the people living in the south of England, he had no notion of the horrifying effect of the Depression in the north. The unemployment rate was 33%, and there was almost no hope of work. We had sunk into an abyss of poverty, which I have described in earlier books. By 1940, however, we had begun to climb out of the pit into which we had fallen, though we were still very poor. My parents were still filled with the public school snobbery of their youth, so I had told them nothing of my engagement to Harry O'Dwyer. They would have immediately condemned such a union as beneath me. Harry was from a respectable Irish working-class family and a Roman Catholic, originally intended by his family to be a priest. Since I was a Protestant, we had agreed to be married quietly in a registry office soon after I was 21, when I would not need my parents' consent. Harry had bought a little house, which was not quite complete when he was killed. I was 21 years and 2 months old when his mother told me of his death, under very odd circumstances, that she did not know that she was talking to her son's fiancée.